a president refuses to hand it over.
A ruling reshapes personal autonomy.
A confession changes the rules.
Three cases, three decisions, and the fallout never stops.
Behind every closed door and every high-profile trial lies a truth the cameras never quite captured. You've seen the headlines, but maybe that's not the full story. This is Debriefed.
This is Sean, and this is Debriefed, where when it's over, it's not always over, and it's up for discussion. I'm joined today by Dennis, Ryan, and Madison. And we're breaking down three cases that shape how power and rights are defined. Let's first start with executive power. United States versus Nixon addressed whether a president should withhold recording conversations during a criminal investigation. Ryan chose this case because he sees the parallel between Watergate era distrust and today's political climate.
Yes.
Ryan, take me through it.
Yeah, so United States v. Nixon, the background of the case was there was a congressional investigation basically into Nixon and his aides and what they were doing in office to basically win the upcoming election for the president. One of Nixon's aides actually had mentioned in a congressional hearing that there were recorded videotapes, that Nixon basically had been recording every single conversation in the Oval Office, Camp David, and a couple other locations.
And this is obviously not common practice.
So funny thing is that presidents did have a history of recording their conversations. I think FDR had recorded a few of his conversations while in office. Nixon was the first one to record every single conversation.
Okay.
He was a pretty paranoid guy to begin with. So like he thought that it was protecting himself to record everything. And that way nobody can misconstrue what he's saying and all of that. But when the congressional hearing had opened up, and of course, the Watergate scandal, where, you know, basically a few agents of the Republican Party were found to have broken into the Watergate hotel, and had were planning on bugging the hotel room to record opponent conversations. So this is happening in that context.
That created the Watergate scandal.
Right. And then that's kind of where the congressional investigation started.
Okay.
And a lot of this really important piece of evidence were these recordings. So Congress wanted to get them. So they issued a subpoena, and then Nixon's legal team had moved to quash the subpoena for the tapes.
Why did they want to get the tapes?
So they knew or had a really good idea, since Nixon recorded absolutely everything, that there would be really vital evidence on there about him coordinating different ways to at least screw up or, you know, obstruct the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who was investigating the issues that he was, you know, the Watergate scandal and all
got
that.
Got it.
So these tapes very well could have implicated him, and they in fact did, because he lost with the motion to quash, did end up going to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says, no, you got to hand over the tapes.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, in terms of like the reasoning behind the Supreme Court, it's something that we've kind of heard recently with some of the decisions with like Trump's immunity decision, where we're trying to figure out how much leeway we can give the president. And the president, I think we can all agree, should have some leeway. You know, it's an important position. He needs to feel confident that discussions with foreign dignitaries and other people are confidential. But then there's this whole other element of criminal wrongdoing. And one of the distinctions between the Watergate scandal and like with the hearings that went on with Trump, Watergate was about a motion to quash a subpoena. Trump, it was about a criminal investigation generally. So they kind of had made a distinction, but the Supreme Court definitely later down the road expanded executive privilege by a lot.
Yeah.
Nixon's era, the court was more concerned about the criminal wrongdoing, and it was kind of flip-flopped. You know, that now it's more concerned about executive privilege and confidentiality and the ability to do their job without obstruction. Or, you know, for Trump, without reprisal, because, you know, that's one of his biggest concerns, was that, you know, he could use executive privilege to hopefully get away from some of the accusations that were being made against him on a couple of different issues.
Yeah.
But his criminal wrongdoing was what was at focus when it came down to that. So
when we talk about this case, we talk about this United States versus Nixon. So that people are not confused, is this the reason why he was impeached?
Yes and no. So the United States v. Nixon was about releasing the tapes.
Yep.
The tapes were why he was impeached. There's a smoking gun.
So this is the first phase of it.
Right.
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 So then he lost that part.
Right.
And then became the tapes.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what was on those tapes that went from privilege to evidence.
So the big issue with the tapes, there was one particular tape, they call it the smoking gun, where Nixon was basically found to have been discussing with his aides on how to obstruct and move around the Federal Bureau of Investigations investigation into it.
Okay.
So, you know, they were discussing various strategies, ways to prevent them from getting evidence, including obviously ignoring or fighting any subpoenas and everything like that. So there were a lot of things that were discussed, but it was almost entirely having to do with how do we get around this federal investigation. So basically he was obstructing law enforcement, doing a couple other things that he was caught doing just on tape. But that was enough to where any political support that he did have at the time completely disappeared at that point. You know, any holdouts were like, okay, Nixon's got to go at that point.
Yeah. My next question to you is, Nixon argued executive privilege was necessary for candid conversations, which I think that we've already could probably agree with. That needs to happen.
Yeah.
What part of that argument failed once the court reviewed the context of the criminal investigation?
It was super interesting with what the Supreme Court did with Nixon is they looked at what kind of privilege Nixon claimed. He actually claimed a really general executive privilege. They said if he had claimed something like a national security interest involved with the tapes, if he was able to demonstrate like a national security interest or some other really important reason, I mean, because there's a couple different ways you can assert executive privilege. And one of those ways is like saying that, you know, this could affect foreign policy or this could affect our domestic defense or our welfare. Those are ways that you can get around and actually assert that privilege. The court said that had Nixon asserted one of those types of privilege, he may have gotten more deference. But the need for confidentiality was far outweighed by the criminal conduct is what their position was.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in terms of like overall, it was a pretty big ruling because they're saying, well, while executive privilege isn't like it exists, it isn't absolute. And I think that, you know, comparing the Supreme Court then and now, I think that the Supreme Court then leaned way more toward protecting, you know, not protecting the executive, but instead, you know, if there's a criminal investigation to further the criminal investigation. Now it's flip-flopped and executive privilege is really the focus. And you know, there seems to be a definite imbalance.
I like how I mean, it was very big because, like you said, it made an absolute power from that perspective, right? Made it the executive privilege from that. Now, explain to me how you feel that today mirrors the mistrust of that situation.
I think, you know, one of the biggest examples, like with Nixon post the smoking gun tape, everyone at that point was like, okay, you know, this is a serious issue. You know, we need to make sure we hold our leaders accountable. Executive privilege is not absolute, right? Nowadays, what we're seeing is we're seeing an executive who, like, no matter what, objectively speaking, he's pushing boundaries. You know, he's pushing what normally would be, you know, what a president would do. He's pushing those boundaries in a lot of different directions. You know, with Trump's criminal investigation, that was where executive privilege came up last and where the Supreme Court had basically expanded the idea of executive privilege. Basically, now only non-official acts, like official acts, are immunized. And now we have to define official acts, right? So it gets really murky.
So let me ask this. Do you think it's fair that these accusations come up, and then after they come up, they re-describe what executive privilege is?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's kind of interesting that there is a standard that already existed.
Yeah.
And then they were like, well, we're going to expand it.
We'll hold you to a different standard now.
Right. And the official acts are so, like, they didn't define it. So it's kind of left to be defined by lower courts. And then the Supreme Court probably, again, will have to take up issues down the road. Because Trump is not the last president we're going to have. So, you know, we're going to have other presidents.
Maybe.
If he has his way.
If he has his way.
But you know, eventually we're supposed, you know, supposed to move on and have somebody else who might push boundaries in a different way.
Yeah, so, of course.
You know, I think that the funny thing about these rulings is that they're so consequential and big. And even if they benefit one president right now, you know, the shoe could be on the other foot. Maybe we have a Democratic president next time around who pushes just as far or even further.
In a different direction. Yeah.
Right. And I think that we need to be careful of that. And I think that, you know, the court in Nixon saw that, that executive power is really important, but we have to be able to hold our leaders accountable. It's okay. I thought that the court's earlier position, where if it's a national security issue, if it's something that could cause us to, you know, lose our defensive edge as a country or something like that, it's important to be able to keep those things
under Of course.
But there are certain things that, you know, there are no kings. We have to be able to answer, you know, or hold our leaders accountable. And I think that the Nixon court saw that. And I think that things are moving further down to allowing the executive to do a lot.
Yeah.
A lot that they couldn't do before. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, perfect. Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
All right. Perfect. The next case we're going to talk about is Miranda versus Arizona, which focuses on whether statements made during police interrogation without legal warnings can be used in court. Dennis selected this case because it's widely recognized, yet it's very often misunderstood. Dennis, tell us about Miranda versus Arizona.
Well, what do you want to know, Sean?
Tell me how it got started.
Of course, I'm just messing with you. Miranda. There was a man named Ernesto Miranda, Arizona. I believe it was 1961.
Three. Only because I have it in front of me.
Thank you for correcting
me. I wouldn't have known that otherwise.
1963, he was accused of rape and kidnapping.
Kidnapping.
The police, I think it was the Phoenix police, bring him down. They have him sit in a room.
For hours.
It was about 2 hours.
Yep.
2 hours. They have him sit there. And he basically gives an oral statement admitting to the crimes, confessing everything that he did in that situation.
He also signed a written confession, too.
He did sign a written confession. Mm-hmm. I was going to get back to that, too.
Okay.
After the 2 hours, and he basically wrote down everything that he basically orally told the police in those two hours, admitting again to all of the crimes and the conduct that he had committed. And on the bottom of the warning, it was basically saying, you know, you weren't coerced into signing this document and giving this statement. Obviously, he goes to trial. Trial, he's found guilty, gets 20 to 30 years in prison. But the big issue was that his defense attorney had objected to his confession being admitted into evidence and being used by the prosecution. The reason for that was is that under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, under the Fifth Amendment, you have the right to remain silent. Under the Sixth Amendment, you have the right to counsel. His attorney at the time had argued that both of those rights were violated. The court there said no, went all the way up to the Arizona Supreme Court and said they agreed with the lower court saying no, his rights were not violated. And then it went to the Supreme Court. The Warren Court, who was the Chief Justice at the time, the Warren Court had a lot of big rulings. It was very progressive at the time, where today we find the court to be a little bit more conservative. But in this situation, they expanded the rights of the individual under the Fifth and Sixth Amendment to basically say you have to be warned or told what your rights are before you are interrogated or really speak with the police when you're in custody. And everybody, I'm sure, has heard of Miranda rights. And, you know, you've seen on TV shows, Law and Order, wherever, they're always talking about you have the right to remain silent. You know, anything you say can be used against you. You have the right to counsel before you answer any questions. If you can't get counsel, we'll provide you one. Do you understand your rights? And do you want to waive these rights and talk to me? Right. And that's now become the staple. But back then, they weren't doing those things. You know, speaking of Nixon, I believe Nixon was the president when the Supreme Court came out with the ruling. And actually, Nixon spoke out against the ruling, saying, why are we giving suspected criminals the right
He didn't like criminals very much.
Correct. Why are we giving suspected criminals? Why are we telling them their rights?
Yeah.
Right? Yep. And obviously, today, to me, it's like a no-brainer, right? We have to be able to know our rights. We have to be able to, so that way we understand what we're getting ourselves into, especially if you don't have counsel present, you're entitled to it and you have the right to remain silent.
Yeah.
He, ironically, even though his, you know, the Supreme Court found that the rights were, you know, his rights were violated, they ended up retrying him without the confession. He was still found guilty.
Really?
Yes.
That's very interesting. That a lot of people probably would not know.
Correct. And he ended up getting another 20 to 30 years. He got paroled, I think, after like 5 years. And then ironically, he got like killed. But I think it was like a stabbing like 5 years after he got paroled.
Oh, really?
So he didn't make it very long. I mean, I would say a classy guy. A lot of issues with the law.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Now, Miranda signed a written confession after the hours of interrogation.
The 2 hours of that. Right? Yes, correct.
What specifically about how they obtained made the court reject it?
Reject the oral and written?
Yeah.
Again, it was the simple fact that they never told him his rights, and the rights were not established in the actual written waiver that was at the bottom of the written confession. All it says is that you're signing that you weren't coerced into giving it, but they never explained to him that, one, you have the right to counsel, and two, you have the right to remain silent. They never explained it to him, and that waiver at the bottom never addressed either of those issues.
Got it. Now, my question to you, you do a lot of DWI defense.
Yes.
And one of the first things that we hear is they didn't read me my Miranda rights, and they feel that their case should be tossed as a result of that. Can you give an explanation why it's not relevant?
We hear this all the time. And it doesn't just apply to DWIs, but it's prevalent with DWI cases. There's two reasons why it doesn't apply to DWI cases. One is Miranda only attaches once you are in police custody, which means you've been arrested, all right? A simple detainment for an investigation purpose does not attach in that situation. So in a DWI investigation, they're pulling you over, they're speaking to you briefly, they may have you do some field sobriety testing and whatnot, but they are not under arrest at that point. That's all part of their investigation.
And now, go ahead. I'm going to interrupt you. What's the difference between detained and arrested? Because it's a very thin line.
It is a very, very thin line. And there's a lot of case law in point that would go back and forth.
Yeah.
But the simple way I look at it is if you were suspected of a crime, the police could detain you for a brief period to investigate.
Define me a brief period.
There's a lot of cases on that too, right?
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, for me, I think it can range. But again, if it's part of the investigation, they can hold you for a period of time. And then when you're actually arrested, usually they'll say you're under arrest, you've been charged, they'll cuff you.
Can they make the argument that detaining somebody for a DWI, for an example, is for public safety?
I'm going to say I haven't really seen it come up in that context.
Yeah.
Could they say it? Sure. I think
because if you're under the suspecting of drinking and driving, what's not to say that you can pull out there and cause an accident that can cause injury?
I mean, I think that applies to everything. That's why they have the limit. That's why they have the right to hold you for a brief period of time to investigate.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it applies to anything.
It goes to the point of why it's okay for them to detain you.
Well, right. That, but also, think about a domestic violence case, right? They might have to separate them, interview them both separately.
Very true. Investigating, very accurate.
Right.
Yep.
So, right. Yes, for public safety. But again, they have the brief. They can briefly detain you to basically have to do the investigation. But again, Miranda does not attach until you are in police custody.
So now, again, if you are being detained, can they use those statements against you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so again, let's do it in the DWI context.
How many drinks did you pull over? How many drinks did you have?
Where are you coming from? Coming from the bar. How many drinks have you had? Well, I had 3 beers. All right.
Okay.
Well, your eyes look a little watery. Get out of the car.
Okay.
All right. They can use all those statements against you until you're in police custody.
Okay.
And then if you're in police custody and they don't read you your rights, and you said, you know, again, it wouldn't be spontaneous, but if they asked you something like, hey, do you have any bodies in the back of your car? And if a person answers yes while in police custody without being warned, that statement would get suppressed.
Got it. So guilty of DWI, not guilty of murder.
Well, if they find the body, you know, obviously with the inventory search, it's possible, but they can't use the statement against you.
Gotcha.
And that's the other important piece, which I'm glad you brought that up. The second part is, so one is you have to be in police custody, but the second thing is it only applies to statements made in police custody. What usually when you're what they call it, interrogation, custodial interrogation. Okay. It only applies to statements when you are in police custody under custodial interrogation. It does not apply to, and especially in a DWI context, field sobriety tests, the BAC, a blood draw, anything of that nature.
Okay. It only because that's statements. Evidentiary.
Those are also evidentiary, but again, Miranda only applies to statements made.
Okay. Got it. Interesting. Is there anything else that people get wrong about Miranda?
Again, the biggest thing is it attaches after you have been placed under arrest.
In arrest. And define under arrest.
The easiest way is what I tell people is they say you're under arrest, they'll tell you what you're under arrest for, and you've been cuffed. That's usually the very clear
cut. Now, answer. I'm assuming there's times, but will they always say you are under arrest?
Not always.
Okay.
There's arguments we can make as attorneys. Like, for example, let's say the cops pulled up on me and they had all their guns drawn. And they say, you know, get out of the car, put your hands on your head. That point, that's more than just a
level of being detained.
A level of being detained in that situation. Usually you're going to be placed under arrest right at that point if their guns are drawn and things are moving.
Yeah.
So those are questions we'll ask, you know, the troopers, was your hand on your gun? Was it pulled or anything like that? And trying to figure out if somebody's been detained or if they've been placed in custody.
Got it. Cool. All right, well, thanks, Dennis. The next case we're going to talk about is Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade addressed whether the Constitution protects a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. Madison chose this case after experiencing the impact of its overturning during the formative periods in her life. So, Madison, tell us about where Roe versus Wade started and the most recent overturning of Roe versus Wade. And I know this is very controversial, so I want your view of this.
I'm going to try and tread lightly, and I've also tried to, you know, get both sides in what I'm going to talk about, because it is a very polarizing topic.
For sure it is.
But something you can't argue about, back to the basics, the core roots of it. In 1970... Norma McCorvey, she ended up going under a fake name, Jane Roe, and challenged Texas laws regarding abortions because it's Texas. They were banned. It was illegal. It was completely not allowed. And so I think...
So she wanted to be able to have the right for an abortion.
Yes.
Okay.
She argued that it was... a constitutional right to have free autonomy within your body. And so, you know, it was Texas. So it was denied and denied and denied. And it finally got brought up to the Supreme Court, where in 1973, it was passed constitutionally within certain limitations, a woman had the right to get an abortion. And, you know, I believe it was like the trimester rules and things like that. Those were put in place. But, you know, it was an overall blanket throughout the United States that if you fell within those regulations, no matter where you were, you could have an abortion.
Okay.
Question for you. And again, I'm just thinking as a lawyer here for a second.
Of course.
So was she pregnant when she appealed?
No.
So she was just doing... I guess the question, and maybe Ryan can shed light on this too, why did she have standing to sue if she wasn't pregnant? Just because she was a woman and she wanted the right? Like,
yeah, do you know the answer? Usually you have to have actual harm.
Right. Right?
And that's a great question. If you as the audience know the answer to that, let us know. I mean, it's a great question.
I just don't know why she would have had standing to sue unless she was pregnant herself.
The argument was it violated the right to privacy. Under the Constitution.
Is that why she changed her name too?
I think the reason for changing the name was more so it is such a controversial topic. She is also originating in Texas. I think it was probably a protection standpoint.
Yeah, I get it.
And then also, I mean, it's a name known today, the 50 years later. I can do math.
Is she alive?
I don't believe she's still alive. I could be wrong.
I knew I should have had her on.
She's definitely, she's definitely a part of a group that would be hurt had she, you know, just by virtue of being a female.
Correct.
The capability of being harmed is definitely there.
It's just, for me, to Dennis's point, I never knew that.
No, it's very interesting.
I never knew that. And to get to a point where it gets to the Supreme Court without her rights ever being violated is just very interesting.
Which
to me.
And obviously silly, but to get something to the Supreme Court's could take more than 9 months.
Yeah, no, so of course.
That's why I'm curious to know how that works.
Yeah, no, that's very valid. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the decision that was overturned recently.
Yeah. I know you said in the beginning it happened in a formative time period of my life, not to be dramatic, because thankfully we are in New York State. New York State is naturally going to lean more towards ideas where abortion is accessible to everyone. It was my senior year of high school. I was sitting in my bedroom on Instagram before my last senior concert. And I remember just seeing my Instagram flooded talking about it. And I was so confused and I was worried, because it's not something I'd ever thought of before. And I was 17 and in high school, and you know, and I had friends who were outside of state lines, and it was really weird to be so young and just to see how, again, thankfully we live in New York State. I will always have that decision available to me, but there's so many other women in so many other states who had that option taken away from them. Clearly, from the way I'm talking, it is very obvious what my views are. I think that, you know, it's not... I hate the argument where people are like, oh, you're pro-choice, you're pro-abortion. Like, let's kill all babies. I think that's crazy.
Yeah. It's extreme.
It's very extreme. I think that, you know, 17 years old, say I lived in Texas, and say something very traumatic to me happened to me the next day. I am 21 years old right now. I could not have a child. I could not have a child at 17. And it's just where I am. And I know kids from my high school were pregnant their senior year or are pregnant now. And that's their choice. And I think there's a beauty in making the decision. And that's why I think Norma, a.k.a. Jane Roe, I think it was beautiful to fight for that. And I think it's scary because, you know, following the overturning of Roe, there's been the threat. I'm going to put threat in quotes. Because there's been conversations about it. Some of it has not gone fully to the Supreme Court, but there's been conversation of overturning interracial marriage, of overturning gay marriage. And it's just, you know, we've made so much progress. And then this one overturns, this one finally flips, and now it's let's bring everything back in. And it's scary to see.
Yeah, I have a couple friends of mine that are... LGBTQ and got married, and as soon as this came out, they were very, very concerned that the same exact thing was going to happen from that perspective.
Well, the other piece that gets me too, that, you know, like you think about Loving v. Virginia, which was about interracial marriage and how it was illegal and they were charged criminally. And that's the concern, I think, based off what Sean is saying, is I think we're talking about a slippery slope here. Because let's say you have an abortion in New York and you were to travel to, let's say, Texas. And Texas has a law on the book that says if you get an abortion anywhere in the country, we can charge you criminally. Now you're limiting where you can travel, where you can vacation without a risk of, you know, criminal conduct in those other states. And same thing about gay marriage. Let's say a gay couple were to travel and that state were to make it illegal, just like Loving v. Virginia did. You know, it's going to be a very, very slippery slope in the long run.
Do you think the most recent ruling on mifepristone was a good step back toward where we should be?
I'm happy with that decision too. And again, I believe.
Tell us about that decision.
Mifepristone, I think is how you pronounce it, but it's a really common over-the-counter Plan B pill.
Okay.
There was a part of the aftermath of this decision was that states started to ban prescriptions being filled from out of state. So a New York doctor can do kind of a runaround and prescribe Plan B to somebody in Oklahoma or Texas. Okay. The Supreme Court recently came out and said that's okay. Okay. A couple of the justices were livid, but
I think it was 7-2. I mean, I think it didn't pass very closely. It was,
I think, Thomas and...
Was it Alito?
Alito and Thomas, I think.
So, and that's the thing is, so again, when we're talking about Plan B, these people in these states can still get access to those, which is important. And again...
Especially if you're going to do that, you've got to be able to provide an alternative.
Right.
I think, though...
Even though the states don't want it.
Yes, and while there are many workarounds, and I do hear about more and more each day, there are also terrifying moments, though. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember it was, I believe, a woman in, like, Georgia. I can't remember exactly what state, and now I'm annoyed.
Virginia.
Are you sure it was Virginia?
Virginia.
Where this woman was, I did not think of it. I thought it was more south. A woman, like, there was so many complications during the pregnancy, and she got rushed to the hospital because this baby's life was about to be gone, and so was hers. And she was in a red state where it was banned, and it was, like, threatened to this doctor, if you intervene in any way right now, your medical license is gone.
It's a very, very,
you're done.
Very real concern.
And now you have two dead... Mm-hmm. Dead bodies, dead people, dead anything, however you want to categorize it, on your hands.
Terrible result either way, right?
It is.
People died.
Or you lose your medical license. Yep. Everything you've worked for in life is gone. Yep.
So let me give you the other perspective.
Okay.
That I don't necessarily agree with. What about the level of personal responsibility? What about you made the choice to have unprotected sex and there's repercussions to that?
Mm-hmm. I get that. I think the advocates for that type of argument should also be the number one advocates for reformatting our foster care system and reformatting things like that. Because if that's the scenario, you know, it was your fault, whatever, and say you just were young, reckless, whatever. You have a kid, you give birth to the child. First reaction is going to be foster care system.
Okay.
Especially if you or your family or whatever, you can't raise it. Our foster care system is one of the most damaged systems in this country. And I think those advocates for, you know, that argument should also be the ones out there fighting for foster care and fighting to help make a better system for these kids who are alive and born and need a better system and need a better place in this country to grow up.
Yeah, I'm very proud of you for making that connection because it's a very intelligent transition to that. As somebody that grew up in foster care, I know how broken that it is. And you are 100% right. If you now take away that right, that's going to fall on somewhere else, mm-hmm. right?
And I, to piggyback off that, I think the point that you're easily making, for me, it goes beyond foster care. The states that actually, you know, that legalize abortion or have abortion rights are also the states
Low income.
Well, it's low income, but those states like New York also has more social programs mm-hmm. for mothers to be able to help raise children they maybe can't afford and all of that. But the states that say no abortions really don't have any of those programs. Right to life, but you're not allowing these children to live.
That's one of my biggest issues when I lived in Oklahoma, that that state enacted very, very similar bans to Texas before they were even challenged by the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So Oklahoma enacted these laws, and what ended up happening is their support systems for pregnant mothers are so poor that they couldn't even meet their basic needs. These are people who will rally about the death penalty, but they don't give a whatever about a child.
You can say shit.
They don't give a shit about the children. It's a very hypocritical
position. Right to life versus right to live.
That's a great point. Let me take a step back, because I don't know if we've really answered this. Why was it overturned?
I mean, the long and the short of it is again, I talked about the Warren court in the Miranda piece, where we talked about Miranda for Arizona. This was also another Warren decision. And it basically took one of the Bill, which one in the Bill of Rights was it? It was, I think it was out at the, I'm having.
They used the 14th Amendment.
It was the 14th Amendment, basically arguing it was an extension of that, the right to privacy, mm-hmm. and as part of the right to privacy,
you have
the
something, right to use your something body. Triggered it, and it happened down south that triggered it.
It was, I think, what the case was that brought it up to the yes. Supreme Court. I don't remember the case that brought it up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it was a case that from down south, and it was from areas that were very low income that created all of these aspects of things. And it just has created this cesspool of growth of systems that are not ready to grow.
Right.
Foster care systems, social systems, all those things from there. So it's just kind of unfortunate to see that ripple effect of all of those things that went into that. Now, I'm going to ask a really weird question. We know who Roe it is. Who's Wade?
See, the Attorney General, maybe?
I thought it was a government position in Texas.
Either the governor or the attorney general.
It's probably the AG.
Okay. You got anything else on this?
I think this topic of conversation makes me really sad.
Tell me why.
Don't
cry.
No, I'm not going to cry. Okay. Phew. I think it's so easy to get so angry and hot-headed about this topic and... You know, what restrictions do you really see about what a man can and cannot do with their body in comparison to a woman? And I understand women have a weird ability compared to men of being able to bring life. But women, I feel like, are just so far more restricted in comparison to men. And I think it goes down to innate, our deep roots as a country. And it just makes me so sad being a young woman growing up in America, of, you know, there's, I could talk for hours about, you know, social expectations and social standards and structures for being a woman and now legal standards and structures for being a woman. And it's just, I think it's so sad that what I can do with my own body is a reason to make two other people argue and hate each other and groups of people hate each other.
Yeah, I mean, I understand how it could create that emotion. I get that. Obviously, I'm not a woman, and I agree with you that it's easier to be a man than a woman. But it's also about perspective, too, right? It's all about controlling the things that you can control and being sad about things that you don't have no control over. Mm-hmm. Now, if you get to a situation where, you know, people do this all the time, they argue for the sake of arguing, right? Do something about it, right? If you want to fight about women's rights, go fight about women's rights, right? You're allowed. People will hear you, right? But I understand and I hear you. It's not fair. And the noise, hopefully, is trying to create some level of equality from that aspect of things.
And again, I try to keep up on this topic, but I keep up on a lot of topics. But one thing I think is important to note is that, you know, what methylprednisolone is, I think like 80 or 90% of women use that drug. And really it's only, we're talking about a very small portion that's going beyond the 6, 10, 12 weeks. And again, usually they say, I think statistically, like 99% of people that have gone past like 12 weeks want to keep the child. Mm-hmm. The only time they need the abortion is either the child is not going to survive or really the health of the mother, which is from an, if we can't change the law or what the Supreme Court did to really advocate to these states that have such strict rules on abortion, then argue at least for the health of the mother. It would be, I think, the first step to try to at least allow for medical necessary procedures. Because frankly, these politicians are not doctors. They're not the boots on the ground fighting for it. So I think those, you know, at least we have to start there.
Yeah. I agree. I think that that's where you see the most progress is when you see a state loosen it up a little bit because there's a tragedy like what happened in Georgia. That should never
Virginia.
Happen.
Virginia.
It was not
one
Virginia.
One of those southern places.
It's not Virginia.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that should never happen. And if that outcome happens, it's wrong. We should look at what's wrong about it.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that would be a pretty reasonable fix, saying, hey, you know, this is an issue. We need to at least loosen it to allow it for these particular outcomes where you know, mom's going to die too, or, you know, you have to pick and choose. You know, they're really tragic and terrible decisions.
Yeah, you're telling them to be God.
Yeah,
it's just not okay.
No, it's not.
Or even back to what we were talking about is, if you want people to have children and not, you know, have an abortion just because they were young and stupid and having a kid, why are we not fostering a better system
right.
to raise these
or
kids
or making
in?
The adoption process simpler.
Oh, my
right.
gosh.
Right. Are there so many broken parts of the system?
So many broken parts.
I mean, I think of it, again, I always think about the social issues. Not just the adoption, but it's all the support of, like, let's say we were to adopt another kid. Can I get help from the government, whether food credits or financial credits for schooling, clothing, all of those things that, frankly, a lot of states aren't doing.
Right.
All right. Let's go to our pressure test segment. The first question is going to be Dennis.
Oh, boy.
If Nixon had framed, we talked about this a little bit, but if he had framed the tapes as a national security issue from the start, do you think the court would have ruled the same way and why?
I'm going to argue they would have still came out the same way, I okay. do believe.
Why?
And here's the thing, right? Obviously, the Supreme Court, I'm just making an assumption here, but my gut says is when they were looking at the subpoena, what they could do in that situation is as the court, the judges, they can listen to the tapes and then make a decision, right? And making the assumption that they did that, they would have found that it was not necessarily for national security purposes, yeah. that he was lying or not using a very, that was not the reason for it, and then still would have ruled the same way.
Yeah, a lot of times they'll do an in-camera review.
Correct.
And they'll look at stuff and go, okay, well, before I make a ruling, at least as a judge, I want to read this. Or, you know, and they'll keep the parties away from it, and just the judge will listen to it.
Yeah.
I agree. I think that once the judge listened, especially to the smoking
and,
gun tape,
and realizing that it was not national security, it was cover my ass.
It was a lot of CYA. There was, yeah. there was some anti-Semitic stuff that Nixon is known to say regularly.
Yeah.
He was not a very...
Yeah, he was not
likeable
a very
guy.
Very, very good guy.
But I do think, like, again, if the court today were to listen to the Nixon tapes, my gut says he probably would have gotten away with it.
Yeah. Yep. I think it's very valid. I mean, we've seen him probably in some arguments worse situations. Madison, did Miranda warnings protect rights or make prosecution harder than necessary?
I think it definitely helped protect rights.
Okay.
I think about times I've got pulled over. I'm not saying I did anything severe. I speed, and I'm sorry. I panic and I freak out, and sometimes I just word vomit. And, you know, I think having the ability to have myself protected in some type of way, especially if it is a more serious situation than driving 88 in a 65, you know, it's nice to have this constitution, these.
Let's talk about that. So I'm a police officer. Mm-hmm. I clock you going 90 in a 65. Mm-hmm. I pull you over.
Sure.
Am I being detained?
Yes.
Why do I being detained for a criminal investigation? It's not a criminal investigation. Why am I being detained? I already know the results of it. I'm not investigating anything. I have the data says that you broke the law.
Right. So it's to stop a moving vehicle, at least with New York, right? You have to have reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. Obviously, a traffic infraction is not, or probable cause, basically, that a traffic infraction occurred. This situation, he witnessed the traffic infraction, so he has the right to stop the vehicle.
So he has the right to stop the vehicle to do an investigation on what?
To write the ticket. He has to get the person's information and all of that. He has the limited time to do that.
So, Miranda, for those of you who get a speeding ticket, and it was like, he never read me my rights, Miranda does not apply on a traffic.
Here's what I will say. Actually, Miranda could apply.
Okay, tell me more.
Yes, Miranda could apply in that situation. However, one, you're really, again, they're interrogating you not for a crime, assuming there's no other issues.
Now, the question is, what? Miranda would have to be a crime? The statements?
It's custodial interrogating when you're in police custody. So I suppose it could be done on a traffic infraction too.
Okay.
All right. But what I will see, it can be done because, again, we see it on disorderly conducts or harassments as well. But what I will say is the statements only hurt you. They already have the radar. They already have your speed. They know you've been speeding. You're going to get the ticket. But the thing I always like to see at the bottom of the supporting deposition.
Statements.
The statements that says, yeah, I was speeding. Sorry, officer, I did this. Just keep your mouth shut, take the ticket, and don't get argumentative with the police. You know,
every time I outright admit I was speeding, I got off the ticket. I've never been ticketed, but with a speeding ticket. Well, I've gotten off three times by just doing that.
Let's listen to the lawyer in the crew.
Well, I also wanted to add to that. Think about how many DWI cases we've gotten where it started over, reason for being pulled over, speeding.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Just keep your mouth shut. It carries on.
Be polite. Don't be disruptive with the police.
That's don't
the
word vomit.
Take your ticket and call Navi Law.
Yeah.
And tell them you saw us on the podcast and we'll give you a discount.
Fix the headlights and the taillights, please.
Please.
Rolling probable cause is what my lawyer friend called it.
Ryan.
Yeah.
Does returning abortion decisions to the state resolve the issue or deepen the conflict for you?
It deepens the conflict. I think this is one of those things that we need a national standard. The reason so is that we don't have some people, you know, because we think about everyone being equally protected under the law, right? If this is left to the states, there are going to be plenty of women in those states who are going to have no access to medical care.
But the argument is now that that's been overturned is we're not talking about equal protection because it's not a constitutional right anymore.
Right. And that's where I get hung up because I disagree. And I think I disagree fundamentally that it isn't a constitutional right. I believe it is. So I think that the decision was awful to begin with. And then any further regression would be really bad. But leaving it to the states, unfortunately, I lived in a state that was very religiously extreme. There's a lot of, heavily conservative. It makes a red state look not so red. It is that conservative. So yeah. Women there, if they run into an issue, they have to go out of state to get an abortion or else they die. And I believe that it is the most restrictive law in the nation, even more so or equally so as Texas. So even medical necessity or rape, I don't think there's an exception for rape. So you start
in
looking
a lot of those states, there's not.
And you start looking and seeing and it's like, this is really bad. There's a huge disparity in terms of the level of treatment you'd get in New York and the level of treatment
you
get in Oklahoma.
That's the struggle, right? Is that if they started making rape legal, right, you're going to see the amount of accused rapes go through the roof as a result of it, right? So that's why I believe there needs to be a national standard for that exact reason.
I agree.
Well, you guys got anything else? Dennis, you got something wanted to pink out?
And listen, I agree with all of you on that point, but I guess to play devil's advocate, right? We choose to live in New York. We choose to pay all these additional taxes. Yep. You know, our taxes are substantially higher than Florida, Mississippi, wherever. Our taxes go to social programming and they go to our, our
more support liberal. That.
Yeah, right.
I would encourage people to move.
That's the point I was going to get. But unfortunately, and to support your argument, why a national standard would be better is because, again, frankly, we're talking about people trying to get abortions, low income. They can't afford the child.
Mobility is so difficult.
Correct.
And yeah. Moving for the purpose of an abortion would be less important than staying where your job is and feeding your family and all that.
So and unfortunately, we're probably in the minority because, as you see, the blue states are losing population to the red states.
Yep.
So, and that is because of taxes and, the financial reasons, but
are people just not connecting that things cost money and that taxes are necessary sometimes to fund those things? Or, they just not like
people want more money in their pocket. I understand.
Three cases, three different pressures on power and rights. This has been debriefed. Until next time, thank you.